Penguin Random House Audio presents Raising Raffi, The First 5 Years. This is the author, Keith Gessen.
For Emily.
Author's note. I wrote this book out of desperation. For the first few months of my son Raffi's life, I felt like I was merely surviving. Through the sleeplessness and terror, I put one parenting foot in front of the other and tried not to look too far ahead. But when this passed, what I wanted more than anything was to talk. I had never before experienced such a contradictory mass of feelings. I had never engaged in an activity so simultaneously mundane and significant. I had never met anyone like screaming 2-month-old Raffi, or cuddly 1-year-old Raffi. "Uck," he would say when he wanted a hug, or scourge of our household, 2.5-year-old Raffi. Through each of these phases, I was amazed by his transformations, his progress, and my own complicated reactions. I wanted to know if other people were going through the same. Parents talked, of course. My wife, the writer Emily Gould, and I talked all the time about Raffi, and we sought out other parents on the playgrounds, on street corners, even on the subway. Some of us, when we talked, couldn't help but brag. "He started sleeping through the night last week," someone might say, alienating their interlocutor forever. Or, "His grandparents took him for the weekend and we slept late." An active in-town grandparent was worth, by my informal calculations, about $40,000 a year. Others went in the other direction. Their child wouldn't nap. He threw his food onto the floor. He bit a kid in daycare. Emily and I were in the self-deprecating camp. But of course, this left out something too. The physical joy of being with Raffi, the hilarity of much of what he did. There was, in short, a limit to what you could get at when chatting with other parents. I felt like these conversations never went far enough. There were books about parenting. Some of them were very good. Most were not. In its main current, parenting literature was the literature of advice. The books diagnosed a sickness, your child's sleep problem, your son's behavior issue, and promised to solve it. When the solution didn't work, you blamed yourself. Then you sought out another book, one that would work better, and went through the cycle again. There was a particular gap, I thought, in the dad literature. In the few books out there, we were either stupid dad, who can't do anything right, or super dad, a self-proclaimed feminist and caretaker. I was sure those dads existed, but I didn't know any. The dads I knew took their parenting responsibilities seriously, were not idiots, and did their best around the house and with the kids. With some notable exceptions, they did less parenting than their spouses. The gay dads I knew hired a lot of childcare. Nonetheless, they thought it was one of the most important things they were going to do with their lives. At the time I started working on this book, when Raffi had just turned 3, I was supposed to be doing other things. I had a novel coming out that I needed to promote, and then a nonfiction book on U.S.-Russia relations that I should have been researching. But I couldn't stop thinking about Raffi. About our situation with him, about the situation of all parents with their little kids. I began taking notes, and eventually I started writing these essays. I felt ridiculous about it at times. To write about parenting when you are a father is like writing about literature when you can hardly read. Almost without exception, in every male-female relationship I encountered, the mothers knew more about their kids than the fathers and parented them better. My own relationship was no exception. Emily was an extremely well-informed parent who also, not long after Raffi was born, started writing occasional essays about him. I love those essays as much as anything she has written. But there were things that I did with Raffi, talk Russian, play sports, yell in Russian, that were particular to my experience. And I came to think there was some value in recording my own groping toward knowledge in this most important of human endeavors, a kind of record of a primitive consciousness making its way toward the light. I was part of the first generation of men who, for various reasons, were spending more time with their kids than previous generations. That seemed notable to me. I recently asked my own father if he remembered my second grade teacher, Ms. Lynch, because I had just called her up to interview her about education. He said he didn't and wouldn't. "But you must have gone to the parent-teacher conferences," I said. "Oh, no," said my dad. "I was at work." My father had relocated us halfway around the world so that we wouldn't have to grow up in the Soviet Union. drove me to every single hockey game I ever played in from the ages of 6 to 16, which was hundreds of hockey games. Almost never traveled for work, and taught me math, physics, how to drive, and how to throw a left hook. He was hardly an absent father. But to him, the idea of attending a parent-teacher conference was risible, whereas I consider the quarterly parent-teacher conferences for Rafi major events in my life. This book consists of 9 essays arranged by subject: birth, 0 to 2, bilingualism, discipline, picture books, schools, the pandemic, sports, and cross-cultural parenting. Each of the essays describes my experience as a parent, draws on some of the literature and conversations I've found most helpful or unhelpful in thinking through this experience, and comes or doesn't come to a conclusion. I've tried to make it so that the essays can be listened to independently if a busy parent doesn't have any interest in, for example, bilingualism. But I've also sought to avoid repetition and place things in a more or less chronological way so that a listener going through the entire book can see Rafi and me and his mother slowly moving into the future. Most of the material is from my personal experience, though as you'll see, one of the things I do to understand my experience is read. Where appropriate, I've also used my training as a journalist to talk with some of the people I thought would have the most to say on a given subject, whether it's the purpose of education, the nature of Russian parenting, or the lessons of parenting research in comparative perspective. I hope these conversations do not seem out of place. They were important to me in thinking through these issues. I wrote some of these essays earlier than others, and in instances where I've changed my mind or learned a lot more about the subject, for example, by having another child and seeing him, at age 3, suddenly turn from angel to avenger, I have tried to incorporate that later insight into the text. The thing I've learned about parenting, the thing that the parenting books don't tell you, is that time is the only solution. You do eventually figure it out, or start to, but by then it is often too late. The damage to your child, yourself, your marriage, has already been done. That is the way of knowledge, though. In its purest form, it always comes too late. Home birth. I was not prepared to be a father. This much I knew. I didn't have a job, and I lived in one of the most expensive cities on the planet. I had always assumed that I'd have kids, but I had spent 0 minutes thinking about them. In short, though not young, I was stupid. Emily told me she was pregnant when we were walking down 34th Street in Manhattan on the way to Macy's to shop for wedding rings. Our wedding was a few weeks away, and I had, as usual, put off preparing until the last minute. I had a fellowship at the time at the New York Public Library in Midtown, and I must have Googled wedding rings near me. Macy's it was. All around us on 34th Street, people were shopping and hurrying and driving and honking. Emily told me, and I thought, okay, here we go. We were going to have a kid. Then I thought, we need to get some very cheap wedding rings at Macy's. I was born in Moscow and came to the United States with my parents and older sibling when I was 6. I grew up in a suburb outside of Boston and found it boring and dreamed of leaving to become a writer. After college, I moved to New York and worked odd jobs and wrote short stories, which I sent to literary magazines, which never wrote me back. To see my name in print, I started doing journalism. I found I really liked it. I also started translating things, stories and oral history, poems, from Russian. Traveling to Russia and seeing its version of capitalism up close converted me to democratic socialism. Eventually, I started a left-wing literary magazine, N Plus One, with some friends, published a novel, and traveled as much as possible to Russia to write about it. This was a decent literary career, truly more than I ever could have hoped for, but it did not bring in a lot of income. When Emily and I met, I was living with 2 roommates in a grand but ancient and cockroach-infested apartment on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn. At the time, Emily was a writer for Gawker, a media gossip website. She was brilliant, beautiful, and very funny. She could also be very mean. She had grown up in an upper-middle-class household in suburban Maryland, but she had a chip on her shoulder. She was also a very good cook. We dated for a while, broke up. She dumped me at a Starbucks in Cobble Hill that later closed during the pandemic, and then started dating again. Eventually, we moved in together to an apartment above a bar in Bedford-Stuyvesant. By this point, Emily had quit working for Gawker and published a well-received book of essays. With her best friend Ruth, she started a small feminist publishing house, Emily Books. She worked for a while at a publishing startup, then got sick of it. The year she got pregnant, she published her first novel, Friendship, about 2 best friends whose relationship is disrupted when one of them gets pregnant. I was working on my second novel about Russia, and had received a year-long fellowship at the New York Public Library to research and write it. The fellowship was the bulk of our income that year. Strict.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?